I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical. I should be allowed to glue my poster. I should be allowed to think. I should be allowed to glue my poster. I should be allowed to think. I should be allowed to think. I should be allowed to think.
Just came back from a few week break and all this sort of stuff, and I think this gives us an opportunity to try a few new things. And what I'd like to, we never really do this in Always Report, but I just want to take like a few minutes. And John, I'd like you to kind of introduce yourself, kind of how you got into this stuff, what, if anything, you feel is, you know, an area you are more, well, you know, better versed in than others, and just kind of let people know who you are and what you do.
Okay. Yeah, well, I guess I started getting into, not Sing specifically, but kind of alternative topics maybe 3 years ago. And that started, I found an interview of Neil Kramer with, on Red Ice with Henrik, and they were talking about the Gates of Awakening. And so they were going through, you know, he was walking through gate one, gate two. I mean, he says people get to the political gate and they see that it's really corrupt, and a lot of people stay stuck in that and they never move past it. But some people move past that and they see that there's a bigger game being played, and that's like the conspiracy side. But then some people get too stuck in that where it's just manipulation and melodrama and all that kind of stuff. And so that's just as... that's not a good place to get stuck either. And then he went on to say that, okay, but if you look below the surface of that, then you see, well, what's the belief system that motivates people that you think are in control, the powers that be or whatever? Why are they going to Bohemian Grove and all this kind of weird, bizarre stuff? So what's that belief system below the surface? So that's another gate that some people don't go through. But then you walk through that gate, and then you get into the belief system, and it's still confusing as hell because it's a just swamp of mystical symbolism and religions from all over the world. It just seems to be this bizarre thing that is hard to pin down. And so it's easy to get lost in that swamp too. And it basically is this infinite regress of stumbling blocks. And so that whole idea of constantly evolving and constantly trying to discover the deeper meaning of things appealed to me. And so Neil was one of my gateways into this kind of area. And before him, I'd come across a little bit of McKenna. And so that summer, I started getting into him more and listening to a lot of his stuff on YouTube. And one of the more interesting things that I got right off the beginning from him was that the universe is a language and the world is a language. It's speaking to you through symbol. And I had always had that inclination just because, well, when I went to school, I took a lot of classes in American Indian studies. And if you do any reading into their general belief systems or how they ran their societies, they were always looking for cues from nature as to not only their spiritualism, but also just basic survival stuff. You know, you hear those cliched stories of the Indian putting his ear to the ground and he's able to track where the deer are or where to go for the winter and all this kind of stuff. But it's like, well, what does that even mean? But if we take that perspective that, well, everything is language, the world's language, everything is speaking to you if you engage with it and are willing to look at it in a different way and try to learn a new language, you can get a lot out of it. So I didn't have the word synchronicity to attach to that yet, or synchromysticism. It really doesn't matter what you call it. It's all the same thing as far as I'm concerned. But I had stumbled onto that idea kind of early on. And so every time I saw that, it like kind of reinforced what I'd already had an intuitive sense was going on. And then maybe about a year ago, you had done, maybe it was a little more than a year ago, I don't know. You went on Red Ice and you did your interview, and I listened to quite a bit of Red Ice over the last few years. And so I decided to get the book, and I liked your interview a lot, and I thought you communicated the points really clearly and in a kind of, you cut through a lot of the bullshit and you were irreverent about the subject in a way that was refreshing. But you're also a very good communicator, so you got the point across at the same time. So I picked up the book and I read through that, and it brought up a lot of the themes that I had been exploring before that, in terms of like Archaic Revival, McKenna.
You mean Think Book One?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Sorry. I actually haven't read Sync Book 2. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Sync Book 1.
Mm-hmm. I just want to plug.
No, it was a great book. Like, it's a cool synthesis of, you know, you have the essays and the written aspect, but it's a real piece of artwork. You know, all the drawings in there, and also the freeform approach of some of the authors and the liberties that you gave them allowed it to be this kind of mosaic that is rare in book form. So that was really cool. Outside of like a graphic novel, you know, it's like as close, it's in a middle ground between a novel and a graphic novel that's like very interesting. So I've just, I guess, been engaging with it more since then. And then I think I started listening to Always Accord earlier in the year. I can't say for sure. Either the first or second episode I heard was the Jan Irving or whatever his name is episode.
No.
I know that's notorious.
It's so common. It's so interesting that's common that people, that's what they gravitate towards initially.
I didn't even know who he was before that. And then I looked into it after and I realized he was like this big personality in the Gnostic community or whatever. Yeah. But just, it was such an interesting psychological exposure that it really did fascinate me, because you guys brought him on as a guest. I'm like, okay, well, it's going to be a nice conversation. Then all these accusations started flying around. It was crazy. I didn't expect that. And that was what was cool about it. I'm really glad you guys had that conversation.
Well, I feel embarrassed about that conversation, on multiple levels. If I had to do it over, I would have checked into myself more. And now, I mean, I listen to it now and I can pull out a few fallacies that I state that if I wasn't under the kind of pressure that I was under, that wouldn't have happened. You know, it's just because you can't do this kind of work under that kind of like pressure cooker energetic, because if you try to, you know, we're doing our best in this realm to stay as true as we can to ourselves and to each other. And if you put pressure into it, it just doesn't work. It's not that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, he wanted to engage it like a debate instead of a dialogue.
Yeah.
I know, David, from my listening to some of the Always Accord, you bring up David Bohm now and then. And David Bohm had that approach where it's a, you know, do we engage in dialogue or do we engage in debate? Because when you debate, you just talk through each other. And he seemed to have that approach where he wasn't willing to compromise on a thing. He wasn't looking to learn. He was looking to tell you what the truth was. Whereas the entire approach of this show seems to be, well, a dialogue and let's learn from each other. And even when you guys have like heated discussions, say about like the ear fucking or whatever, it's still, you guys have a sense of humor about it, and it never gets like super personal, or you're never like yelling through each other, and you might have disagreements, but you're always willing to reconcile your belief systems and to be, see like the validity in another point of view, instead of saying, well, you're wrong, and like, let me show you how to think, let me show you what to believe, and you just haven't done your study or whatever, and you're just so that whole difference, you know, it's, we have to move beyond this, oh, it's a debate, it's an argument.
Yeah. Well, there's enough of that out there, right? I mean, we got our little show here. Why do we need to exert the same dynamics that are, you know, breaking the world apart. Why, like, on our little island of a thing or whatever it is, you know. Yeah.
If I may, I mean, this is one of the things I'm most proud of. So you mentioned Jan Ervin. After we did Red Ice, he went on a long... So he already hated us after that Always Report episode. He claims that we tried to set him up. He claims that we're CIA. I mean, it's, you know, for me, that's pretty obvious.
That's flattering.
You know, we're sitting here on our fucking $10 equipment trying to put together a radio show. And, you know, it's yeah, and I guess in that respect, it's flattering to think that we're doing a good enough job or seem professional enough that you think we're well-funded or something. But at the same time, it's kind of ridiculous. So he went on this whole thing that we were CIA, we set him up, we did all this shit. And then after we did the Red Ice for Sync Book 2, he went on a whole other thing. Again, we're CIA, we're government agents, but also that we are Zionists. And he was saying that we were pushing this racist Zionist agenda, that we were, like, you know, Jewish Nazis trying to, like, all this sort of stuff, which was pretty wild in itself. But where I want to take this is that in the last few weeks I've gotten a few emails from people, and it seems like it's like one person writing under different emails because they're just so almost like verbatim the same thing, but that people taking issue with Kyle Hunt and Violator Hellspawn and Hellspawn's friendship, I don't know if it's even a current friendship, with a guy who goes by the name Celtic Rebel. And Celtic Rebel and Kyle Hunt are pretty notorious for their theory that, like, you know, Jews run the world and all this sort of stuff. And Kyle apparently just started this, like, white supremacy website, which I haven't looked at it, it sounds pretty fucking disgusting, but it wouldn't totally surprise me. To be honest, so Kyle strikes me as a pretty blatant anti-Semite, and I don't, you know, I'm not one to just call names or anything, but that's, I don't, anyway, he's in the first Sync book, and so someone's saying, here you have this guy who just started a white supremacy website, who's, you know, an obvious anti-Semite in your book, in your first book, and who, you know, you link to his website on the author's page. He's one of the authors, so I'm linking to his website. Not his white supremacy website, but his old kind of Sync website. And someone saying, why are you supporting white, what was it, homophobic, anti-Semitic, and something else. Oh, misogynistic. Like, it basically said, I have a question about your show. Why do you have so many extreme positions on your show? You come across as homophobic and anti-Semitic and misogynistic. And I was like, whoa, 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 what are you talking about? What show is this that you're talking about? And then they responded back, oh, I'm sorry, I want to clarify. It's because you have Kyle Hunt in your first Sync book and Violator Hellspawn, who doesn't strike me the same way, but who apparently was friends with Celtic Rebel, etc. And I would like to at some point, but I don't want to do this, John. We have you here today. I want to kind of really focus in on a different area, but just since this came up, there's something really amusing to me and something that tells me I'm doing a really good job if people can't tell if I'm spreading the Jewish conspiracy, like if I'm part of the quote-unquote Jewish conspiracy, or if I'm an anti-Semite. There's something kind of amusing about that. It's like, you can't have it both ways. Obviously, we're presenting a wide enough spectrum without putting a belief system on it that people can't figure out what it is we're pushing. And the answer is we're not pushing anything. We're trying to present a bunch of different viewpoints, and obviously I have things that I would agree with more than others. I think anyone who listens to this show can know pretty clearly if I, we have two of our radio hosts are Jewish, a few of the contributors are homosexual. I don't think Kyle Hunt should really discolor the whole thing, but I don't agree with Kyle Hunt's viewpoints on there being a Jewish agenda or any of that shit. Nonetheless, what I was interested in was his sync content. What did his looking at all this information, was there any kind of information or data or viewpoint that we could learn something from? And there's nothing in the sync book that's promoting his other beliefs. It's just this is another viewpoint that maybe we can learn something from. And I have to say, as much as this is frustrating to kind of deal with these slanderous comments, it makes me feel like I'm successful in presenting a really wide spectrum if people can't figure out what extreme I'm on, when I'm actually probably not on either. But does that make any sense?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, that's the whole thing. It's like to assume that nobody has anything to contribute that's meaningful just because you can't agree with everything they say. Like, you often bring up the concept that, you know, we all have our reality tunnels, and there's really no... There's some that are probably get closer to the truth than others, but all of them are incomplete, ultimately. And even the ones that seem like the most backwards or misinformed have a bit of truth in them. Like, you look at the Republican... Oh, I'm getting a little bit of echo, just FYI.
Sorry.
Oh, that's
I'm,
okay.
I'm making okay. sure that we're recording this call because I have headphones on and I'm looking at the input and the input. Okay, we're back on.
John, I think okay. you were speaking.
Yeah. All right. So, like Kyle Hunt, and does he like have anything to contribute? Just because his reality tunnel might be skewed in a certain direction. So, in terms of what he contributed to the first Sync book, I think I went back and looked a few weeks back when we talked about this in another call that you and I had, Alan. And I think he did the article on like the rainbow alphabet. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. So that's a really valuable idea because that syncs up or connects these ideas of colors and harmonics and numerology, which are all feed into each other, which is a very sophisticated conversation and also pretty critical to understand. If you really want a deep understanding of what reality is, you have to dig into those subject matters. And so if you just tune somebody out and just like, oh, look at this anti-Semite, I'm not going to listen to anything he has to say. Well, you're tuning yourself off from a whole level of experience. And it doesn't mean you have to listen or believe what he says about who rules the world and who doesn't. That's insignificant to the conversation almost. All reality tunnels have something to contribute. I mean, if you look at Nazi history, right? It's like, well, why did they adopt all the symbolism, all this weird stuff? Is there no truth in that symbolism? Is there no relevance in the kind of occult ideas that not motivated them to kill people, but motivated them just to be fascinated with this other world? The swastika, is it evil or is it not? I mean, when you really look at it. So if you're just going to attach surface identities and labels to everything, you're going to tune yourself off and tune yourself off from other reality tunnels. And to the latter, or maybe to the former, I'm forgetting which, this whole idea that, okay, well, Zionists are running the world or it's a Jewish conspiracy, that assumes that all religions started with Judaism, that there was no religion before Judaism, which is ridiculous. And when you really look at the religion of the Illuminati or whoever you think rules the world, it's a synthesis of a whole bunch of different regions, non-Jewish and Jewish alike, but which all seem to draw upon a main source, which is not Jewish.
Well, and it's not. There's an important thing to qualify when you're looking at Zionism, is that they are projecting scripture into a nationalistic lens. So if you're talking about Israel back when, were you talking about a nation? If you apply it in a national context, you can make it mean all kinds of other things. And there's plenty of rabbis that recognize that and object to it, because who said that we're talking about a nation? I mean, that's a recent development. If you're talking about a nation in a national context, then, you know, you're talking about something else. So anyways, I just want to put that out there really quickly.
Yeah, no, that's completely right. Again, these ideas of nationalism and religion and spirituality have all become intertwined in this kind of fucked up way that we can't really, you know, untangle it and get to the truth. So again, just to close that up, it's just about, you have to engage with this stuff, and you can't label anyone as anything without exploring everything they have to say first. And so, yeah, this whole idea of saying you're part of a conspiracy or you,
and I think
you shouldn't.
Sorry, to cut you off. Just
no,
say,
go
just,
ahead.
Just to qualify that again, further is to say, and just because you've explored it doesn't mean that you support their belief system.
Right.
Right.
You could read Mein Kampf. It doesn't mean you're a Nazi. It means you
right.
want to, I mean, it's like, there was an incident that happened with a friend's friend who got their house gassed. And she's a college student, and she got books for a class she was in college taking. Like anarchy was part of her, she was doing a report thing on anarchy, and she identified herself with an anarchist when the police arrested her for books. Like, she got books in the mail from Amazon.com, and they busted her door down for books from Amazon. Like, true story. And
holy
shit. Yeah, and she's like the, you know, sweet girl. She's like, you know, dresses like somewhat, I guess we would say, as punk rock, to sound like an elder, you know, the punk rock look to her. And yeah, but super sweet girl. It's just like, you know, she's studying it. Is she going to go blow something up? That's not in her, you know. She doesn't realize, too, that their associations with anarchy are completely different than her own. She has to qualify what she's saying. They say, are you an anarchist? Well, is that synonymous with terrorist? Like, what are we talking about? Are we talking about the same thing? I mean, that, you brought up David Bohm. That was a very common issue with Bohm. He's like, we can go on having a conversation using the same words for completely different things and argue on for days. You need to slow down and qualify what it is, how you're using the terms, you know?
Well, let's move in that direction, because like I said, I feel like I've really wanted to have John on this show for a while, and as much as I appreciate this conversation, I want to hit some things that I feel like you have a unique ability to bring to the conversation. I don't know how long you guys have today, so if you don't mind, can we kind of turn the conversation in that direction?
Yeah.
So you mentioned David Bohm. The way John and I started talking was, I believe, was after I did the Corbett Report show. And I made a comment on Corbett's show where he asked some, I made a comment about quantum entanglement, and he basically shot that idea down, and I kind of kept the conversation moving, like, well, I don't want to get into a thing about quantum physics here, because it's a, you have less than 40 minutes with commercial breaks, and then he sure. takes other phone calls. I'm like, that's not even why I'm, what I'm trying to talk about. But
yeah, I saw that interview.
You know, the thing is that you could, which school of quantum physics are you referring to? You know, he's saying, well, that's not what quantum physics says. Well, there are multiple schools of quantum. John contacted me after that show and said, like, I think I have some of the information that ties in with, you know, even more of a science background that can better put into words what you were trying to say there, or something along those lines. So John and I started having these Skype conversations, which reminded me very much of how our conversation started, David, and when we had Bill on. Like, the way we start always record was we just try and have a conversation. We'd end up talking for, you know, 2-3 hours. So John has a podcast/radio show that he does as well. John, you want to throw out your website or your YouTube channel?
Yeah, I don't have a personal website. I do have my blog, which is jmag0904 at WordPress. And that's where I concentrate all my articles and videos. But I have my YouTube channel, which is FOKS0904.
And I will link those up.
I'll
make sure to link both of those up in the show notes.
All right. Yeah, I appreciate that.
But that's how John and I started talking. And we have these conversations about both the physics side of sacred geometry as well as the mystical side of these things and where the crossover might apply. And things like, David, you've talked about, these different like vector metrics and how these things apply to both a physical reality and a mystical truth, et cetera, et cetera. And John's someone who speaks very well on that subject, and I thought it would be really nice if we can kind of go in that direction. And maybe a nice kind of starting off point is why I asked you guys to watch the Jim Henson's The Cube and see if that's not an interesting launching off point for... maybe so, maybe not, but that's... I'm wondering if you guys... John, you started to say that you had watched that video. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. I approached it from an angle where I didn't assume Henson or whoever wrote it with him knew everything that they were putting into it. They might have had some vague idea. Obviously, certain things, they spell it out for you, but other things... Whether they were aware of like the esoteric or scientific implications of that, I'm not sure, and I won't even speculate because I don't know enough about Henson and his background and so on. And as you guys always talk about, it's like, well, synchronicity and just kind of hints at what the universe really is just kind of bleed into artwork regardless. So whether they intended it or not, I mean, there's just stuff in there. And so just this whole idea of the guy in the cube, well, you can start drawing from history to get a precedent for that. And I guess one of the better known things is the Vitruvian Man, which originated with the ideas of Vitruvius, who was a Greek architect. But then you had, you know, the famous artwork of the Vitruvian Man, and he's in the circle, which is in the cube. And so what does that mean? And so I've always, not always, but definitely over the last year or two, I've been pretty interested with that whole concept. But I got into that concept mostly from explorations of like the ether or the quantum vacuum or whatever you want to call it. That subject matter really interested me. Maybe I got into it mostly because I had a kind of guilty pleasure where I really enjoyed ghost shows. And they're corny as fuck, right? But at the same time, a lot of times... It's TV. Okay, I get it. But it doesn't mean everything on TV is fake. And no matter how they dress it up or try to make it appealing to an audience, I think there's like still truth behind a lot of the experiences that are documented there. And even if you don't want TV, I mean, there's a fair amount of paranormal stuff in society is all well documented on the internet. It's just a matter of digging. So I was always curious, you know, well, where the hell do you go when you die? And it seems like these people are like almost trapped in this kind of background if you believe in ghosts. I mean, where are ghosts? What are they? Why do they come through in like electromagnetic noise? So those ideas, I guess, have probably underwritten a lot of my interest, even subconsciously, into those ideas. But anyway, to get back to that, the quantum vacuum and stuff, there's a good number of theories on the structure of it, like the physical structure. And at least since relativity, general relativity and special relativity were adopted, the idea of space as like a physical medium kind of went out the window. Because right before the turn of the 20th century, they did these things called the Michelson-Morley experiments, where they were trying to detect an ether or, you know, the space continuum, the physical existence, and they figured they would be able to detect Earth's movement through it. But the results came back basically borderline negative. They weren't above background, in other words. So they weren't negative, they just weren't conclusive enough to say, well, it really does exist. And that provided a launching point for a theory like Einstein's that basically said there is no reality to space beyond the relative relationships between the things. So he said the things define space, and space itself had no existence beyond the things. Similar to how you see certain interpretations of quantum physics that say there's no reality of the experiment until you look at it, until the observer is with it. So while they haven't been able to reconcile relativity in quantum physics, that is a major link between them, is this relative or observer-based reality that there is no objective space. But I think you can reconcile these ideas, and maybe we'll get into that later. But anyway, as I dug into more models of what is space, a couple, and it started to come up, and one was by this guy, Harold Aspin, who was a British physicist. He died a few years ago, but his writings are all cataloged on this on his website, and his wife and keeps it going. And he was well credentialed. He was like the patent attorney, lead patent attorney for IBM for about 20 years. So he would analyze all the technology that was coming into IBM, all the submissions, and he would, you know, tell them whether it was valid, if it was worth the risk. So the guy knew what the hell he was talking about. And in his free time since the 1950s, he developed an idea of what is space actually, beyond Einstein's concept of a mathematical convenience. Is there a physical reality to space? And his idea of space was that it's a liquid crystal, meaning, and this is an actual existence, it's a phase existence in reality. You see it in, I think, cell membranes. So you see it in organic molecules. So it's this kind of middle ground between a solid and a liquid, and it's called a liquid crystal. But anyway, you can look it up on Wikipedia if you want more information. But anyway, he perceived space as kind of a liquid crystal for various reasons.
That's like Yasod. You know, Yasod on the Tree of Life, they call the sapphire pavement, and it's supposed to be crystalline, but it's the beginning of the nominal existence of space. So when we contact space, this is what we come across, is essentially a liquid crystal. It's trippy. Just one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why you have to explore a lot of different topics to synthesize them and to really bring their meaning into context. But
I'm not a fan of. I've actually never seen an episode of the show Breaking Bad, but I know that's like really big right now. Would you say, with a little pun here, instead of crystal meth, it's like a crystal mesh?
I'm so glad you brought up Breaking Bad, and I'll get into that as soon as I...
Dude, I just have to jump in really quickly and say that you're talking about whether or not Jim Henson's thing with the cube was intentional and this and that, and the first thing that came to my mind was the dark crystal. Frank Oz, yes. And Jim Henson, and the fact that I haven't, that's one of the very few examples of an album going in sync with a film flawlessly that completely blew me away, that the film was made after the album was released, which means if it was intentional, it would have to be on the part of the directors. And the thing with the, you know, the dark crystal is a crystal is whole, and then the crystal cracks, and that's what separates the Skeksis from mm-hmm. the Mystics, and then you return them, and then they become the Erxes. But it's funny that there's a Crystal Method album called Vegas that starts out with the sample from the Dark Crystal, where they're like, "Until the crystal cracked," and then anyways, I was thinking of the Crystal Method when in my thought process just like 5 minutes ago. And this is a show about synchronicity, so I can't not mention that. Okay.
Okay. Sorry. So just to finish up my point real quick. So he saw it as a liquid crystal, but he defined it as, well, there's a fluid dynamic to it, but also there's structure within it. There's a cubic structure, and these cubes are constantly shifting and undulating around and compensating for matter to make space for things to exist. So it's dynamic, but there's a structure to it, and it's this coexisting cube with a circle on inside of it, basically. So it gives a very real and substantive scientific framework for, again, that idea of the Vitruvian Man, which is based in ancient architecture, which is based in these ideas of the Fibonacci sequence and golden mean and all those things. So it links together a pretty wide spectrum of philosophy and science into a kind of a unified whole. And he's not the only one that has postulated that space has a lattice structure to it. There's another guy from Israel named Simhoni who again, interestingly enough, he postulates very similar ideas, and they've developed independently of each other and around the same time, like from between 1960 to now. And that's where a lot of these models came up. So again, like you see this a lot where models or inventions kind of clump together in time. Like the telescope wasn't just invented by Galileo. I mean, there was other models popping up around the same time, but his just got the most attention. So, but there were like four or five other people that they have reviewed.
It could be a hundred monkey situation too, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, like even like the steam engine, all these fucking inventions, they always come in bursts. And these models and ideas seem to come in bursts. So it almost seems like the universe is like, you know, when the timing's right, it throws the ideas out into the world for people to pick up on them and for us to learn from them and to continue to synthesize these ideas. So anyway, it seems like space itself and the vacuum or the ether, whatever the hell you want to call it, it has this cubic structure. But, you know, where's the circle come in? Well, you can perceive the structure as like a vortex. Really where one begins and the other ends, I don't really see much of a difference. Really, a vortex is really just kind of like a circle that's been perturbed a little bit, and then it changes its structure a bit, so it turns into a vortex. Right. It's a circle or a resonating structure that is like facing more resistance, so it becomes more twisty, so to speak. So the circle inside can be interpreted as a vortex. Go ahead.
Oh, I was the lines of a cube. I've seen as the vectors of the line geometrical structure within a sphere or a circle, if you lay it out two dimensionally, is that you're basically looking at the lines of force that hold the bubble together, so to speak. So it's distribution. It's like almost just like weight distribution. But if you're saying that space itself is a vacuum, if you're starting out with that assumption, then it follows that there would be these lines of force that are holding, because in order for something to exist, it literally has to stand out in space. What's propping it out, you know? And that's why you see these lines of force. That's why if you create distribution on one side, you'll see a direct compensation on the other end, or in various parts, all responding. You could even argue that if you put a distortion in, that there's actually response from every part of the sphere. Which would explain a lot of things. Like, that's like what is a nuclear blast the result of? You're literally splitting an atom. An atom exists in perfect equilibrium. You're disrupting its equilibrium. And what the blast is it trying to compensate and not being able to. Like, it tries to fix it, and it can't. And so it's just like, kaboom.
Yeah.
You know, if it's like sort of the every action has an equal and opposite reaction, do you think that sometimes these ideas, this sort of explosion of very similar ideas, could be part of that reaction to, like, as, you know, we've entered a new age of time, or as new ideas enter the newosphere, whatever terms we want to use, that the sort of 100th monkey effect is partially that reaction? Like, how are human minds able to comprehend this new data or new you know, zeitgeist of thought and culture and etc. What I was noticing with Henson's The Cube is I really kind of kept on the idea of the similarities between that and 2001: A Space Odyssey, particularly that the actor in The Cube, I believe his name is Robert Stahl, really looks very similar to me to Kirdalea in 2001, and particularly like that he's in this white room that it's just this grid pattern, and if you look at the 2001 sequence, he's in a white room, like the floor is a white floor with these big gridded lines. It looks very, very similar.
Don't forget that the station on the satellite, not the moon, but actually it might do it on the moon too. I don't think so. But when they're walking down the hall, the ceiling is the same floor. So like the floor at the end is the ceiling at right after the apes. So.
Correct. Yeah. So it's very much a very similar set design. Now again, this is a simple grid and all this sort of stuff, but. There's a scene in The Cube where a scientist is explaining some of the quantum physics behind reality or lack thereof, and then throws a hammer through the wall. And on the other side of that wall, you see this, what looks very much like the Stargate sequence. What I also thought was interesting, so it's like breaking through that cube, and it's funny because in that thing, they also make the point that his is rectangular. It's not actually a cube. It's his, the, one of the other guys breaks into his room and says, my cube has all squares, but yours is all rectangular. So it makes me think of the monolith, etc. What I think is interesting is going to 2001, the fact that he goes through this cubic rectangle, and what does he see but a sort of torus, like John was describing. You know, that Stargate sequence is incredibly sort of swirling grid work, which there are parts of it that look very much like you would be traveling through a torus.
Mm-hmm. And just getting back to the part in the cube where he throws the hammer through the wall, and you, as soon as that cube breaks open, you hear this kind of buzzing, and it's in the beginning of the movie and right at that part and maybe one other time, but it almost sounds like computer data. It's like that stereotypical computer information running through a computer sound, that science fiction-y sound, and I can't help but think of like information when I think about that, or when I hear that noise and computer information. So we're like, are we in a computer program, right?
The set, and, do you remember the woman who comes in, like she's like the interior decorator, and she says, this cube was designed by a machine. Just to throw that out there.
And then, like, yeah, and then she said she used to work for one.
Yeah.
And she's one of the people that's able to move in and out. Correct. So she used to obey the machine, but she's a decorator. Okay, so she seems kind of pompous and stuff, but at the same time, she's a decorator. She might be a creative person or someone that can look beyond the day-to-day reality or sees the value in art or creation, which is really goes hand-in-hand with like identity reclamation and moving beyond, you know, the survivalist mentality of day-to-day life that we're kind of stuck in. So the people that move out of the cube are the artists. You have the decorator, you have the musicians, you have the actor.
You got the janitor.
the janitor does, but the janitor goes in and out to seem to keep him in. Like, they throw the hammer through, and he's like, don't pay any attention to that. Here, I'll close it up for you. I'll fix it up for you. And all these people that are running the show, he calls them crazy. He's like, there's some real weirdos that like run this place. So, and he brings him like the telephone. He brings him these material things, and he seems to be a friend, but at the same time, he seems to be like helping to facilitate him staying into that space.
Hey, almost as if he's still working for the machine.
What's the name of the device? That's the point of meditation device. There's like the
Rama something.
Yeah, that shit.
The Ramadar.
Ramadar. It sounds like Ramadan, but it reminded me immediately of the black stone at the Kaaba, and how it's a sacred cornerstone of the cube. And then, you know, he breaks it open and it's strawberry jam. But I loved that relating to the most holy thing is like, yeah, it's
and the structure itself, it's a, again, you see that circle structure. It's, and when it blinks and when it like goes, it fades in and out, fades in and out. And when you look at the inside, it's just a bunch of concentric rings. It's subtle, but it's there. And it's this archetypal shape of the resonant circle. And that is, again, representative of the vortex. And again, like our bodies are in proportion to the Fibonacci sequence and so on and so forth. And that's embodied in the spiral. So in ways, like human beings, all organisms are outgrowths of spirals in one way, shape, or form, from the embryo out to a grown form. We're really just, pentagonal spirals. And really, vortexes can exist as a number of shapes. They've created vortexes that are hexagons, pentagons. They're just not circles. So they can take on these kind of shapes that you wouldn't associate with a moving fluid.
Right. Well, they're all extrapolations of the isotropic vector metric, right? So
in a sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you can extrapolate all four platonic solids. For the more crystal hippie folks, you can just think of the Flower of Life, because from the Flower of Life you can take all the platonic solids, so any vortex is going to be have to be on some level some extension of the Flower of Life.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's about like pondering on that. That is the foundational geometry. That is like what everything comes from. And again, you have to make some value judgments about what that is, because you can only dig so deep before you just hit a wall of, well, what's really going on. But that is foundational. And to understand that and what it means in terms of harmony, balance, creativity, and all the spaces in between, that can bring you a certain amount of enlightenment, whatever you want to call it, but a certain amount of freedom, understanding that the world is not so rigid, that it's not as cube-like as we perceive. And the only thing holding us back is ourselves. Like the people coming in and out and say, well, you can leave anytime you want. That's up to you. But as soon as he's really confronted with questions like, are you interested in the scientific basis of all reality? And he just looks bored, mm-hmm. and he wants to be a scientist and he doesn't really give a shit. And it's this lack of curiosity or this kind of settling on a certain point of view or a certain way of living that keeps people trapped inside the cube. And so you can move within it in a creative way, but you can also get out of it. But you have to, like, he gets out of it at the end by finally saying, you know, he proclaims his identity. He says he knows who he is. He's finally like seems to be inching out, or, you know, bursting out of the cube in that way, that kind of identity cube. And that's finally what allows him to get out. But then, as soon as he leaves, he's like, oh, well, everything's real again. Again, he settles back into this absolute view of the world, and then he's stuck in it again.
I feel like part of it was also when the guy said, well, now you know what reality is. And he's like, yeah, I'm still not sure what all that was about. It's like he still hasn't processed it.
Right. And he's not willing to engage with what's necessary to really understand it. And that's both spiritual, which is represented by that Ramadar and the monk that came in, and also the scientist. So clearly, like, Henson had some understanding of the merger of those two things as necessary to gain, like, a full understanding of your place in the world or how the world works to begin with. Hmm. So it was a cool movie. Again, like, I don't know that everything was in there intentionally, like the rabbits, right? He talks about the 4 tons of chocolate rabbits that mm-hmm. the people that place ordered. And a couple episodes back, you guys were addressing that idea of rabbits and UFOs and how those tie into synchronicity. And so again, you see rabbits come up, and I don't know if that's intentional, but again, that's just a minor sink of.
I came across the other day an image of an astronaut from 2001: A Space Odyssey in that hall that I was talking about, and he's holding a copy of Playboy, and it's just like, it's a real photograph from back in the day, like it's an advertisement in Playboy or for Playboy or whatever. But I just immediately was like, "Whoa! Follow the white rabbit." Down the
that's perfect.
I'm like, well, because, you know, they wouldn't be allowed unless, I mean, Kubrick is pretty intense about that kind of, you know, thing.
There's, well, I think the other thing that struck me is when the hammer gets thrown through the wall, the maintenance man says, oh, you threw a number 47, right? And so he brings in this 47 patch to replace the hole over the Stargate. But the novel, 2001: A Space Odyssey novel, has 47 chapters in it. Mm. So,
does it have any significance? I noticed that too, but I really don't know enough about numerology to know if 47 has meaning.
47 is something that Jason Brer and I have kind of had a number of conversations about. And 47, for him, he connects it to, like, the Black Dahlia. It's basically this idea of, like, a sort of spirit into matter, or the breaking of these vessels. So it's sort of perfect for that kind of sync. For me, I've seen it as very much of a lunar number, which, you know, you have obviously 2001: Space Odyssey goes to the moon, and transcends the moon, and I was trying to put, I'm trying to remember why I thought that would apply to the.
I just had my mind blown.
Please, yeah, because I'm trying to remember what how I tied this into the cube. But go ahead.
Okay, so when you look at that picture with the guy with the Playboy magazine in 2001, you can see right in the background the Hilton sign, right? And then you guys know the Millennium Hilton right in front of the two towers, modeled to be to look like the monolith from 2001. So there's this whole idea of the 9/11 ritual as an opening of a Stargate kind of idea that Jay Coates has, you know, put out there. And I found it really interesting that if you watch the series Mad Men, when the representative, the main guy, the Mr. Hilton, when he's looking for an advertising campaign. He turns them down specifically because there was no mention of the moon. He's like, I want the moon in the advertising. Which if you think about it with, you know, that you have the Hilton sign 2001, then it's the Millennium Hilton in front of, you know, the 2001, towers. Like that's, and then the whole end of the last season, it keeps focusing on Rosemary's Baby. They go to Rosemary's Baby. They have a advertisement that they're making based off of Rosemary's Baby for aspirin, for St. Joseph's. And then the little girl is reading Rosemary's Baby. The Draper's current wife is dressed up like in the red onesie with 8-pointed stars all over it, the modeling Mia Farrow's character. Like, it's just Rosemary, but what is Rosemary's Baby? What we've gone into here is creating a moon child. And so there's a link that's made in the series between in a sense, synchronistically, between the Hilton man wanting his moon advertisement and the moon child of Rosemary, kind of.
Okay, that's perfect, because I found through a series of synchronicities, something came to my attention this last week that I didn't know how to drop on everybody. I feel like this is a deep rabbit hole waiting to be uncovered. Is working with this guy who's an artist who wanted to design, a tattoo for himself, and he's has like Scottish and Celtic lineage, so he was looking up different Scottish and Celtic. I kind of like, you know, like there's like those Celtic knots and all this sort of stuff. He's trying to make a tattoo design and trying to figure out what looked cool and blah, blah, blah. So he started showing me this one kind of design, which I really struck me. It looked like a stylized compass and square, like the Masonic symbol. And it's called a crescent and V-rod. It's a Pictish crescent and V-rod motif. And so I was like, oh, that's really interesting. I was like, where did you get that design from? And he's like, oh, there's this thing. He pulls it up. I'm going to drop a link in here to the Skype chat. And if anyone's listening, you can do a Google search for something that's called the Hilton of Cadbol Stone. That's Hilton, H-I-L-T-O-N, of Cadbol, C-A-D-B-O-L-L.
It's a monolith.
It's a fucking monolith, a Scottish monolith called Hilton.
What the fuck?
What the fuck? And now get this. So a big part of it was missing. Like, apparently the thing was broken in half, like our dark crystal. And when did they recover the bottom half of it?
2001. Hey, how do you like that its location is Easter Ross, and there's the white rabbit?
Yeah. Exactly.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty fucking interesting.
That's cool.
Again, I don't know what exactly to make of that. I'm just dropping that out for anybody who wants to dig into it. It seems like.
And looking at it again, just from my reading of how matter resonates or spawns into existence. I don't know if you guys have ever read Richard Marek. He wrote this book called The Venus Blueprint. He's been interviewed on Red Eyes once, but he's kind of obscure. And he digs into the history of religion, but he views it from a harmonic perspective, like a music theory perspective. And he comes to the conclusion that, like the idea of Solomon's Temple, you have the two pillars,
and
then you have the gateway in the middle. And what does that really mean? Well, he comes to the conclusion that it implies that, again, going back to this whole idea of space as a cubic structure, or at least there's some lattice structure or like some kind of physical constitution that allows a fluid to kind of ripple inside of it, and the cube contains the ripple. Because otherwise, if you throw a stone on a pond, it just runs because it's a linear medium. There's nothing to interfere with the waves. It'll just keep going and going, and other waves will just go through it. But if you have a nonlinear medium or some kind of resonance chamber, a fluid, its waves can interfere with one another. So if there's a boundary condition, the waves will continually interfere and grow and grow and grow. So that's why the human body is like a spiral. That's why you see so many spirals, because matter, again, whatever is in the background of the vacuum, or whatever the hell you want to call it, it has to be nonlinear to a degree, whether there's cubes there or it's just a highly nonlinear fluid that can interfere with each other that brings out structure. So he sees the Solomon temple thing as the archetypal basis for all creation. So you have the two boundary conditions, which represents either the golden mean as like a boundary condition or the cubic lattice of space. And then you have that stargate, that opening, that eruption in the center of creation that then like hits the boundary, reflects back in on itself, hits the boundary, reflects, and builds and builds and builds until it becomes something of substance. So that's my perspective on that too. So again, like if you can view these from so many perspectives, and if you want to incorporate like the more scientific side of it, I think it's kind of fun to do so.
You know, there's the whole thing with Solomon's Temple where David is originally going to build it, Solomon's father, and is told that the temple will not be built by human hands. And then Solomon goes and builds the temple. And what I find really interesting is that, you know, the Star of David is the seal of Solomon. And that is the most archetypal representation of the temple itself, which by extension you get the tree of life, right? So the tree of life is meant to be folded in as the star. It being pulled apart forms the temple in this world of form, like still archetypally.
Right, because the Star of David is an upward-facing triangle and a downward-facing triangle, which would be the twin pillars, the masculine pillar and the feminine pillar, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, if you have them apart, you have the twin pillars, and if you put them together, you get the Star of David.
Right, and that's why that's Joachim and Boaz is established in strength. So literally the pillars are the force that it takes for us to do that. And that's our that's our conquering of space-time, basically.
I love that you just mentioned Oz, because, you know, I was sort of in the back of my mind, I remembered that John had asked about the 47. Well, 47, right, if you just simple alphanumeric switch, 4 is D and 7 is G. D.E.G., which is Dorothy Gale, who goes to Oz.
Ooh, nice.
John, your Skype photo here is Dorothy from the Golden Girls. Or Dorothy on the Golden Brick Road.
Nice.
Right? Dorothy Gale is a Golden Girl. And all these things. And actually, so, John, I don't know if this is public information. Don't give any specifics. But you live in North Carolina, right?
I do.
Okay. Have you heard about this thing happening this weekend? There was, in North Carolina, there was apparently in the like late 70s, some guy built a Wizard of Oz themed amusement park. And then he like died of cancer. So this thing's just been like rotting. But every year, for one weekend a year, they reopen it and let people go in. And that's happening this weekend. And it's apparently, I thought it was closer to me than it really is. It's about 2 hours, but I'm trying to find a way to go there. Like, I want to go to fucking Oz this weekend. Some old, like, dystopian, rotting Wizard of Oz world.
It's only this weekend?
It's only this weekend.
Well, if it's 2 hours from you, it's probably about 2 hours from me, because you're about 4 or 5 hours from me to the west. So I'm sure it's like probably somewhere in between us.
It's apparently kind of near Boone.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's probably like 3 hours away from me, but it's not too bad. I'll actually, I'll see if I can like arrange to make it out. I'll ask my girlfriend if she wants to go.
Yeah, for the record, I'm working Saturday, and the other, I have a friend who was considering going also. He's also working Saturday, so we're both off Sunday. So we're thinking about maybe making the trip out Sunday, if that means anything.
Okay, yeah, I'll look into it and I'll let you know. That's cool.
It just seems so, like, if you have to look at the fucking website. It's like, it looks like the cheesiest, rotting, I don't even know how to explain it. Oz Theme Park, North Carolina. Let's pull it up. Yeah, if you just Google, so it's Emerald Mountain, Land of Oz Theme Park. If you guys Google that, just look at some images. It looks kind of fucking surreal.
And it's old enough where it almost looks like it's like a natural part of the environment there. It's strange. I mean, it's goofy and cheesy a little bit, but it's old and weathered, so it kind of blends in and looks more organic.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure it's going to be terribly cheesy. I have no doubt it's going to be terribly cheesy, and yet I think I'm going to have a great time if I can make it. Oh, look at this picture. So apparently they do weddings there. Look at this. There's a picture of the, oh, that's fucking beautiful. Here's a married couple standing in front of the gates of Oz. I'll just drop this in here.
Yeah, I see it. He's got glasses.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh. I want to use that in a collage.
She looks kind of like Kirsten Dunst from Melancholia.
That's true. Did you watch that?
Not yet, but we're doing that for next week. So okay.
I'm doing a showing tonight here actually for some folks. So, but I don't think you'll be able to make it.
It's a little.
I still have to see that as well. I've heard good things, but
I'm talking specifically about playing the Smashing Pumpkins, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness over the film Melancholia, starting it at the 24th second of the film. It's incredible.
Yeah, I saw you I went to your website and I saw that was one of the music over movies that you featured on there.
Highly recommended.
And God knows, like, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness is one of the few albums that's, like, long enough probably to make it through.
Yeah. It does. It's just the only song to repeat is the first song, which is the title song, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness. I'm going to send a letter to Lars Van Trier really soon, I think, and might send him some artwork kind of like communicating. Just because it's too much. Like, it's like, if he did it intentionally, then fucking awesome. I'll send him a letter. If he didn't do it intentionally, that's way more awesome, because you got to watch this. So, yep.
Can we jump back into Breaking Bad just for a minute? Would that be
please,
okay?
Please, yeah.
So I don't watch too much TV. Like, I don't have cable, but we have Netflix here, like the streaming Netflix. So there's a handful of shows on there that I really like, and Breaking Bad is one of them. So I watched it probably twice over and just saw the most recent season once. And it's not, you know, it's the esoterica, it's not pervasive, but there's definitely like parts, especially in like season 2 and 3, where they start playing with these ideas of synchronicity and like, is this even possible beyond chance? Because you see kind of Walt trying to reconcile his very scientific view of the world with all these coincidences and synchronicities going on around him. And not to spoil anything for anybody, but most notably when like his partner's girlfriend dies, and then Walt is indirectly responsible for her death. But that very night, he goes to a bar and runs into her father, who's an air traffic controller. And they have like a conversation just about the girl that he just helped kill. And then later on, like, he's so distraught at work that the air traffic controller leads to like a crash over Walt's house, which ends up, you know, exploding over his house, and all this debris falls around him. So all these coincidences. And later on, like a few episodes later in the season, he's obviously feeling guilty about the whole thing, but he's trying to reconcile these ideas about, well, like, how could all these coincidences be happening? This doesn't make any sense. And even earlier in the show, he's having a there's a flashback where he's having a conversation with an ex-girlfriend, and they're dissecting the constitution of like the human being. So he's writing all the equations, and ultimately they end up with like 0.1% that's unaccounted for. And she says, well, that's, you know, maybe that's like the human soul. And he says, well, there's nothing but chemistry here. And he's alluding that there is no soul. We're only flesh and blood, you know, get that out of your head. But then later on, he's dealing with this weirdness. And I think that is archetypal of probably a lot of people's experience. I mean, obviously it's not like his, but we all go through these streaks where we just encounter these strange things going on, but we're told by science, or we're through osmosis, we absorb it through osmosis, and just the way our materialist culture is based, it's like there's no such thing as anything beyond there. Coincidences aren't meaningful. It's probability theory. It's this or that. And so I like that it plays with that idea. And also, like, it also does draw a little bit upon like the quantum vacuum and like the soul and the spirit and where it goes afterwards, because after the girl dies, they're showing her father in her room, and she is painted a mural with the pink teddy bear that ends up in Walt's pool. And also she's kind of caught up in the streams of space. And so like she painted herself kind of getting caught up in the stream. So she almost projected her own death. And so it plays with those ideas really well, not for the entire series, mind you, but I think anyone that's like looking for just a show that's trying to explore those ideas somewhat, it's awesome. But anyway, I went on that for, I just didn't know if you guys had seen it or what you guys thought about it.
I haven't. It sounds interesting. I'm kind of like, almost, oh man, it's like the Mad Men thing. Like, I don't usually watch shows like this. I don't watch television. I don't own television. I watch internet stuff, but it's freaky. Like, it's like, what the fuck are these people up to? Because they show the sun card at the end of every episode with the conquering child, you know. So you got, you know, by extension, I guess Horus represented, you know, on the horse there, leaning to one side with the banner. And it's like, are they like up to something? Like, are these people up to something? Like, in terms of like, I don't know, conjuring intelligences or something like that, or directing people's consciousness in a particular way, or what? Really weird.
Have you guys seen Carnival? Ellen, I know I mentioned
it
to you a while. Oh my god, I fucking love that show. I've seen it. I've watched that show more than any other.
Yeah. Well, I wish it would have kept going. That's like,
yeah, I mean, it's too bad.
Leaves you hanging there.
Right. I mean, they wrapped it up to a reasonable degree, but anyway, it's like his synthesis of the world's religions and like how he views characters like Jesus Christ, I think, is like more accurate than most people's perception, and is probably in line with even what like Philip Dick wrote. I haven't read all Philip Dick stuff, but Ubik, Vallis, and his exegesis, I think, are like a trinity of books that if anyone really wants to know what like he was about, that's the foundation of like his spiritual experience.
And
it's just, again, interesting, getting back to the cube, in his exegesis specifically, he, like, similar to Alan's experience in a way, he began seeing, like, the cube is, like, we're encased in the cubes, or we're encased in squares. He saw the human aura as a square cubic aura, and that we're within it. And while we have free will to play within it and even jump between cubes at times, there's a deterministic side from the cube that basically sends you signals at certain points in your life. It's like, all right, now's the time to kind of like confront this, for your spiritual development or whatever. So that's how I, for me, that's how I reconciled determinism and free will and how those two things can coexist, was reading his exegesis. And I haven't read it all, but honestly, you don't have to read it all to get the point. He repeats himself pretty often. And if you can get through the first couple hundred pages, you kind of know what he's talking about. But again, even through visionary experiences, so you have the scientific view of space as a cube and a fluid. And then Philip Dick, Allen, for example, and even this other guy named Russell Wallace, he also came up with the same conception. He had a mystical experience, and he saw the spirit realm as cubic, but with vortex fluid running through it. And so I can't see that as just a coincidence. It's a pattern. I think you have to respect the patterns.
Sure, and that one goes way back. I mean, particular idea is not a new idea.
I can't just say, oh, it's just me as a subjective observer attaching meaning to everything, because these are objective patterns outside myself, and other people see them. Yes, it's subjective, but there is something, there is a reality to stuff. And I think stuff like near-death experience and psi phenomenon hints at the subjective spiritual realm. We can't really interpret it. Again, we attach subjective meaning to it, but there's an objective existence to it. It's there. It's just a matter of reconciling it and figuring out what it's telling us.
So, just very basic, like I was saying earlier, for something to exist, it literally has to stand out in space. Like, if you look at Madame Blavatsky's A Secret Doctrine, the whole basis for that is a nominal existence. So she goes on for days and days and days and days and days, focusing on the other side, which you can't. There's nothing. It's never going to be tangible in the way that we relate to something being tangible. You can't study it through any of the means that we normally study things. It's a complete reversal, and so that's really a tricky area.
And man, there's no progress. Almost all significant progress has come out of, I mean, not all of it, right? But so much has come out of like visionary experience. There's examples of like psychics predicting certain elements and actually motivating the scientists to look for them, and the scientists find them and win Nobel prizes for them. That happened with argon, for example. Mm-hmm. The classic example is Crick discovering the DNA molecule on acid. Mm-hmm. You have Beethoven, Mozart, I'm forgetting which one, it might have been both, who basically the music came to them in a flash. They didn't have to think about it, it just appeared in their head. So music, the Nikola Tesla, all his technologies came to him in a flash. It wasn't worked through with mathematics, it was all in his head. And that's why you don't see a lot of his work hasn't been saved, because it was all in his head, it just came to him. And so you have these visionaries in the modern world, and then you can tie that back to the shamanic experience, where shamans for time immemorium have gone into what, you know, Alan Moore calls the idea space, whether through drugs or through deprivation that allow them to hallucinate. And they bring back answers for their tribes or for their cultural groups, whether it's medicine or guidance about what to, you know, whether they should move or whatever. It is the guiding principle for, again, what I consider progress, however you want to perceive that. But it's this idea space that is the reality, and then that lends into this idea that, yes, that we're in an illusion. It's not a literal illusion that we can feel pain and like there's consequences to our actions. But if you want the real thing, you got to go below that.
Totally.
What did you think of the fact that in the cube, there's that one I thought is a great scene when he's going, I'm not projected, I'm not projected. And they're right. All kind of like images on a screen. Which, when you were saying the real thing, you have this, who the hell was it? Is it like Diana Ross or somebody? Like Diana Ross and Marvin Gaye, that song, Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing.
Ain't nothing like the real thing, baby.
Exactly. Yeah. He's like, I got your picture in a frame. Like, I got your picture hanging on my wall, but like that doesn't do anything for me at all, or something like that. And it's like, the picture is one thing, it's the, you know, signifier, but it's not the signified. And then there's the question of, is the real thing even the real thing? And on one level, of course, it is. That's how we exist on a day-to-day level. But to take this in another little quick tangent here is, like, even the whole idea of the 2001 monolith being the movie screen, and the man in the cube is at some point shown he's on TV. He's in a, you know, he is the man on TV. This is a play.
Yeah.
It's not real.
It seems so direct. I was like, as I was watching it, I was like, is this really, like, is this where they got it? Like, it felt like that, because it's so the same thing. You're watching this guy realizing that he's in a film, just like David Bowman. I mean, that's the one thing with 2001 that I've really, like, walked away with, that I'm pretty certain about, is that that's the whole premise, is that he's realizing that he's in a movie. Just like, and it's a reflection of ourselves realizing that we're in a grand illusion, you know? Seems pretty straightforward.
Excuse me, I know this is, well, a bad time, but I just wanted to congratulate you and shake your hand.
Well, on what?
Well, as I interpret what you're doing here, this is all a very complex discussion of reality versus illusion, the perfect subject for the television medium.
What do you mean, television?
Oh, this is a television play.
What?
You don't believe that?
Of course not.
I should have thought you'd want to. After all, there's only one other possible explanation.
Which is?
Hallucination. That you are altogether insane.
Tell me more about the television part.
Well, there's very little else left to tell, except, of course, it will end happily.
Are you sure?
Of course, I can probably prove it to you. You see, this is the television medium. All this has been electronically recorded in advance anyway.
What?
Yes, if you'd like to see how it turns out, why, we can watch the last part of the show.
This is ridiculous. How can I see something that hasn't even happened yet?
Here's the picture now. This is just the last part of the program.
Hey, that's me in there.
Of course.
But I'm still in the cube.
Of course you're in the cube, but you're healthy and happy. See, you even got the girl in the end. The perfect storybook ending.
Wait! Wait, this is not a happy ending. I don't want this girl. Wait.
Well, we don't
Hold
need
on.
The sound. If I were you, I'd be very pleased with that ending.
Hey, I hate this ending. I hate the whole thing. It's a nightmare.
This is the television medium. You can always turn it off.